Here's me talking about something I don't know what I'm talking about, but I am passionate.
From Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm Hari Kunabolu, both the Mac Daddy and the Daddy Mac. Am I right? Mm-hmm. Crisscross, 91, 92.
We're two friends and stand-up comics and dads trying to make sense of American politics.
When you attempt something as ridiculous as that, you're bound to get yourself in some trouble. Sorry, John Kerry.
In this season of Politically Reactive, we've done that a few times. And on this episode, we're here to clean up some of our messes, starting with the reality check on Puerto Rican statehood from organizer and scholar Rosa Clemente.
It's every white liberal's dream right now, and they can, like, don't dream about it anymore. It will never happen.
Followed by a 101 course on asexuality, because clearly we needed it.
I think that the stereotypes were coming into play, because those are also things that people say to me.
And finally, we delve into a Supreme Court case involving child slavery and giant multinational corporations.
And so just like really, really like fucking sick stuff.
Which we should have asked a guest about, but we didn't.
Who has the time? Then we take a moment to reflect on bad decisions made by somebody else. Our producer, Matt Martin. He cut too much of the funny, come out.
Matt would say he cut out some of the needless nonsense.
That needless nonsense defines the show.
Hey, Hari.
Hey, Kamau. Here we are, huh? The last episode of the season. Yeah, man. It's a lot better than the last time we left when Trump was president. And now Trump's not president.
We did what we meant to do when we came back. We wanted to make sure that Trump did not win a second term. We did that. Good job, us.
Yeah, we shifted the national discourse. We got people to vote for the right guy. We did wonders. We changed the world.
This is the My Bad episode. And the minute you say we got people to vote for the right guy, I'm suddenly hearing all sorts of like, well, actually.
Look. This is obviously, Joe Biden was not our top choice. I think we made that very clear. Uh-huh. But if you had to choose between the two of them in this stupid system you do, you chose the right dude because it's always two dudes.
It's always two dudes. Yeah. Well, not always, but generally.
Well, one time, yeah.
I mean, it's funny that you bring up two dudes because I've really hit my limit of white dudes this week. I mean, white dudes are always white duding generally.
Well, hold on a second. What's your limit?
I don't know, but I had in the last week, I think whatever it was, I was three away from my limit and I've hit the limit because there's been three in the last week that I've been like, oh, God. And just to be clear, not all white dudes, hashtag not all white dudes. Twitter is just a thing that I use because I have to. But if I was not a person who needed Twitter, I would not be on Twitter or social media. Maybe Instagram. It's fun to show a picture of a bunny cake like I did on Instagram yesterday. Because happy Easter to you, by the way.
Happy Easter to you, fellow Christianer.
This happens every year on Easter, but yesterday I was so clear on the fact that my kids have no idea what Easter's about, really.
There's like, a lot of unpacking if you're going to tell that whole story, right?
I know. It's a lot of like, okay, I mean, I think the older ones have a loose understanding of the guy named Jesus, like a loose, like certainly they're more understanding of who Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy are, but we're not a church-going family. But Easter is like you put on some nice clothes, you eat candy all day. It's basically like it's like Halloween, but the candy lasts throughout the day instead of just at night.
A couple of quick thoughts on Easter that have been on my mind. I find it a little annoying that there's a bunny involved in the marketing of Easter because that feels like, as a Hindu, that's really our thing with the animals. So it feels like it's encroaching our ground a little bit. And secondly, it seems very insulting to Jesus that a bunny was invented because it almost feels like, what, you don't think he's big enough to carry his own holiday? He's already carrying the biggest one. You don't think he could do the small one?
No, he's not. Santa is carrying Christmas. How dare you, sir? How dare you?
Fair enough. The president is not good. The president.
We will not take Santa slander on this show, specifically on the My Bad episode. We will not give Santa his credit, his dap. But yeah, so this week I had three like white guys, fills of white guys on Twitter. And I try not to get involved, especially when I see like this sort of weird like left on left violence that happens every now and again on Twitter, you know, when people on the left are out lefting each other. Yeah. But this one I just felt like, just fucking stop it. So Sarah Cooper, who we're going to talk about later in reference to this show, sent up a tweet. It's like, beauty trick, pull your mask up so far over your nose that it hides the bags under your eyes. you know, fun little thing. Sarah's a good writer. It's a fun, that's, I like the fact that she's not just the lady who lip syncs Trump. She's actually a very funny comedy writer. And that's whatever. You like it or don't like it, ain't no big deal. And then your friend Glenn Greenwald tweeted.
Why does he have to be my friend? I don't know this man.
I thought you guys were friends. You're like, you're all in the same lefty circles. Anyway, so he quote tweeted, Trump's departure made her disappear faster than MSNBC's ratings.
Why? First of all, he's not even fucking lefty. He's some weird mix of stuff that I don't understand.
But to me, it was just like, why did you? I mean, it also sounds like the first draft of a Jay Leno joke. First of all, let's just be clear. It sounds like an old school Tonight Show monologue joke that they'd be like, we can do better than that. It is not really about her. And it's also, why are you hating on this woman of color who had a good year, who's in showbiz and is working to keep that year going? Why do we need to hate on this person?
And speaking of one-trick ponies, don't people know you for that one thing? Because you didn't even do that you reported on and you got the information from the other guy?
Well, my thing is, do your thing, but why are you going after this person? Who's sitting around going, it's time to take Sarah Cooper down a peg? And through some weird like MSNBC ratings, and then suddenly people are like, well, the ratings are up. And he's like, well, they're not. And there's all this argument about MSNBC's ratings. And I'm just like, none of this was necessary. And again, I have a soft spot for Sarah Cooper. So it just really was like, I just was really like, ugh. So that was one. Then your other boy, Mike Huckabee.
That is terrible. I do not I haven't seen the movie I Heart Huckabees just because the word Huckabee is in it. So let's not. I have no connection to this man.
So the day before Easter, I believe it was the day before Easter, he sends out this tweet. I've decided to identify as Chinese, identifies in quotes. Coke will like me. Delta will agree with my values, in quotes. And I'll probably get shoes from Nike and tickets to MLB games. Ain't America great?
I mean, look, come on. This might sound harsh. I'm obviously against anti-Asian violence. Mm-hmm. But I would make an exception for Mike Huckabee.
if he's Chinese from now on, if he's identifying as Chinese.
Chinese Mike Huckabee, I that's the one. Chinese Mike Huckabee. I'd make the exception.
I mean, people pointed out it's a transphobic thing, too, because it's like trans people just identify as something and aren't that thing. Because I was like trying to figure out a clever way to say something. I was like, nope. And I just quote tweeted, this is a really bad person. I just feel like we just got to lay it where it is.
Yes.
That this man who is literally a Baptist minister, is a minister, and always talking about Christian values, polishes it up under this folksy, like, I'm from Arkansas, but just is using all this folksy charm and fake Christianity to try to hide the fact he's a really bad person.
He's a real piece of shit. Grade A piece of shit. Fuck Mike Huckabee. Here's another tweet Mike Huckabee wrote today. Which again just reinforces how bad a tweeter and comedian he is. Breaking wind from CNN. He meant breaking news, but he said wind because it's like a fart he's saying. Breaking wind from CNN. Coke will announce name change today to Woca-Cola, which has been approved by the Chinese Communist Party and by the leftist loons, who the company bows to more than their actual customers. Hashtag cancel culture. When you're writing a joke that's so bad, Dennis Miller needs to punch it up with clever references. It's like, fuck you.
And to me, that's such a dad joke because Woca-Cola would have been funny 5 years ago. Like, that is such a, like, I'm not saying I don't see the joke there. I'm just saying that joke left us a long time ago.
Well, also, if you're going to write a stupid joke, at least end the thought with it. You close on the joke. You don't stick it in the middle and then babble on for another three sentences.
Whoever's writing his jokes is phoning it in. Like, they clearly don't feel like they're being paid enough anymore. It's one smashed watermelon away from being like a Gallagher joke, as far as I'm concerned. Finally, this tweet is, these vaccine passports segregate people and strip them of their freedom to travel internationally. Vaccinations are important, and I encourage everyone to get the COVID vaccine, but how would you feel if international travel also required other vaccinations? That's from your friend, Dr. Drew.
God, Dr. What kind of doc? Is he a doctor?
Well, that's what I tweeted. I was like, once again, we all Google, is Dr. Drew really a doctor? Once again, we have to go, wait, is he really a doctor? I know Dr. Phil's not a doctor. Dr. Oz is apparently a really good doctor in his real doctor life. But
Dr. Dre is not a doctor. Is he from that school of doctoring?
I feel like the minute you become a person who makes the majority of their income from TV, you don't get to claim doctor anymore. I just feel like if you're like, you just, that doctor's your, at best your side hustle.
So we get some information from our producer, Matt. So Dr. Drew is actually a practicing physician who is board certified in internal and addiction medicine, still runs a private practice.
If Dr. Drew walked into my, like I was, went to the doctor, they go, we have a doctor who'd like to talk to you. And Dr. Drew walked in, I would be like, I am out of here. I am not. They have figured out a way to split their professional life. And this is true of Dr. Oz. Apparently he's a really good doctor. I think he's a heart surgeon. But they've managed to go to sort of in their minds go, this is different than that. But they want to be addressed as doctor in both places, which is totally misleading when you send out stuff. Because just for the record, many countries require that you get certain vaccinations before you go in there. I went to Africa, to Kenya, and they were like, would you like to come to Kenya? I was like, yes, I would. They're like, here, get these shots first. If I had said no, they'd be like, then enjoy staying at your house.
Also, it's probably in your best interest to get those vaccinations when countries are telling you to get those vaccinations. There might be a reason for your safety and the safety of their people that you get that vaccine.
It's a complete non-issue.
I'm all for getting the COVID vaccine, which will protect you and me from a disease I didn't think existed for real. Mm-hmm. However, I think it's unfair that we can't bring the virus internationally and spread it at a faster rate.
We can't. As a
doctor.
As a doctor.
As a practicing physician who is board certified.
I connect this to all, these are all white guys. These are all white guys. Yes, just like this, just yammering it up, just with no consequences. There was some article that came out that said like 50% of Republicans now believe that the January 6th insurrection was blown out of proportion. This is a Reuters article that they took a poll, and 50% of Republicans. And I think that's because the white guys like Trump, Mo Brooks, Ted Cruz, I'm gonna throw him in the white guy category. If any Latinx folks want to take him out of that, please let us know. but those white guys got to just go out there and just spout nonsense and order an attack on their own government. And because there are no consequences, now half of Republicans are like, maybe that wasn't a big deal when those people stormed the Capitol and tried to hang Mike Pence. Maybe it wasn't a big deal. Maybe, you know, I think it was Antifa. Now that I think about it more, I think it was Antifa.
You know, always good to end the season on a strong anti-white rant, and it's what we do, and it's something I'm going to miss doing for a little while. It really is a joy to do that with you, W. Kamau Bell.
Yeah, well, we will continue these anti-white rants, but we'll just do it on phone calls and text threads,
which only you, me, and the government can. Yes. Listen to and follow from now on.
So if you want to find out what we're mad about, get a job at the NSA.
As we wrap up this season of Politically Reactive, we're trying to live up to the goals set by our guest, abolitionist and pleasure activist Adrienne Marie Brown, who talked about how important it is to be able to get things wrong, to take responsibility, and be okay with it.
I think in the future, we're able to have really good conversations about when harm happens, how do we recover from it. I find in my personal and intimate relationships right now that I am making really good apologies, taking accountability much faster, never assuming that I can't cause harm. And so it's much more easeful. Like, I'm just like, oh yeah, I'm messing up every day. And then I learn and I don't make that mistake again. I move on to new mistakes.
And we definitely want to clear the space for future mistakes. So we're going to address some of the things that you all have called us out on, either for getting wrong or failing to get right enough.
Like when we were talking to Mark Spears about professional sports leagues and political action, and neither of us mentioned any women's sports leagues. We just expect women to do the right thing.
Oh, I don't know if we... That doesn't sound good either. That sounds a little bit objectifying, Hurry.
Are we going to need a my bad for the my bad?
Yeah, I'm sure we will at some point. But I think the thing that I think I would say, I'll claim my part of this, I just really was only thinking about the Major League Baseball, the NBA, and the NFL. I was not thinking about professional sports leagues overall, when of course the WNBA has led the way with activism, especially around the Black Lives Matter stuff. And of course women's soccer is very political and done a lot specifically around pay equity. And at the beginning of the season, we did an episode about court expansion with my friend Aaron Belkin from Take Back the Court. Again, I'm on the advisory board of Take Back the Court. We were talking about court expansion as a part of a democracy agenda, and Aaron said this.
The Brennan Center says that you will add 40 to 50 million voters to the rolls. You unrig the system by having automatic voter registration, statehood for D.C., Puerto Rico, and Guam.
Now, the moment I heard Aaron mention Puerto Rican statehood, I thought, it's not a little more complicated than that, Aaron, but I'm going to let you flow, which I think happens on this podcast regularly because it's a wide open conversation. We let people go. But what we're not good enough is sort of like making sure we go back in and go, hey, that moment, let's explain that and be clear.
Oh, yeah, because when the episode came out, I heard about it from my partner, Jocelyn, who is Puerto Rican and very much against Puerto Rican statehood, and more importantly, uncritical commentary on Puerto Rican statehood.
Yeah, that comes from her partner, who she has decided to have a child with. Yeah. So we wanted to revisit the question of Puerto Rico status with someone who has a deep knowledge of Puerto Rico's history, who also regularly goes to Puerto Rico, has been going there since she was a kid and regularly goes back and has done a lot of activism and journalism around Hurricane Maria. Also a friend of mine. She's an organizer, political commentator, scholar, one of our favorite people, and apparently our most booked politically reactive guest. What Celine Dion was to the Oprah show, Rosa Clemente is to Politically Reactive. Thank you for coming back on the podcast. We appreciate it. We always love having you on.
Like I said, three times. And yeah. If I count your show, United Shades, is four.
That's right.
But Hari hasn't done anything without you with me. So it could be five, though.
She's looking for a booking from you, Hari, independent of me.
Rosa, how many times have you been on United Shades?
Once.
Oh, that's one more than me.
Which is why you don't have an Emmy. See, now it's like if Hari's in it, he'll win the Emmy.
Rosie was on United Shades of America, the episode where I actually went to Puerto Rico. We talked about Puerto Rico. And so one of the things I learned in that episode is that the idea that Puerto Ricans want to be a state is not a thing that we can accept as the truth. And so on the podcast, I let the bus go by and didn't stop the train. I'm going to own up to that, knowing that we should probably address that. We didn't.
What's said was now with all this talk about DC statehood, right? This supposed growing movement of people wanting Puerto Rico to be a state. And I'm like, no, it's white Democrats realizing, oh, wait, they can't vote? Well, let's still keep them a colony, but let's give them the right to vote. It's never going to happen. It's every white liberal's dream right now. And they can don't dream about it anymore. It will never happen. Every 2 or 3 years, there'll be these plebiscites. Do you want that happen in Puerto Rico? Puerto Rico has a very high turnout rate. So usually in Puerto Rican elections, they've said 84 to 91% of the population will vote in all the elections on the island. The last three times they've asked that question, they call it a plebiscite. The numbers of Boricuas who even went to vote dropped over 60% because we're smart and we're saying we're not going to participate in this farce anymore. So that's never going to happen. We will never be a state.
I just want to how that's just how flat. That's just not going to happen. It's not a worthy discussion. Next topic. I appreciate that.
What is the feeling regarding independence?
Puerto Rico, since it was invaded in 1898, has always had rebellions, right? And even before the invasion, some of the first enslaved rebellions took place on the island of Puerto Rico. That's always been part of who we are as a people. People have to understand that America then invades Puerto Rico, overthrows the duly elected leader of the Dominican Republic, and puts in a dictator, Trujillo. So once the U.S. military is there, what they begin to install is administrative governors who were all part of some type of military people, probably high-ranking ones. And from that day they invaded, our people have been fighting back. And there's very significant markers, but three really big ones. 1917, Easter Sunday, there were grandmothers and mothers who were in church and then came out and they had guns and old school rifles that they had hid under their dresses. because they heard that a military assault might be coming into Ponce, which is where my mom was actually born, not in 1917, but they massacred 114 people that day in Puerto Rico, the United States military. So after that, more and more, like, we need a revolution. So you begin to see a grito de Lares, a huge rebellion in Lares, Puerto Rico. People are beginning to join the independence movement. Then at that point, Albizu Campos, the foremost independent leader, is rising and giving fervor to people joining and willing to die for Puerto Rican independence. And the United States government, with the military in Puerto Rico, tried to assassinate him twice. They did not. But the third time, they put him in the Atlanta federal jail. And then you're going into the 50s, more and more like revolutionary struggle. Then you begin to have an underground struggle that's like, we can't be talking to these dudes no more. They're the military. They invaded us. We have a right of self-determination. We can fight back by any means necessary, according to the United Nations. That's happening. Then you're getting into the 60s. They've killed Albizu Campos. The party's a little bit floundering. But then because of the Black Panther Party rising, which gave birth to the Young Lords rising, you would then have Puerto Ricans who were migrants during the first wave of migration to the United States, who were young and were like, yo, part of our work is here in the United States, but our work always has to be focused on getting Puerto Rico free. It's a really amazing connection. If Fred Hampton hadn't met Chacha Jimenez and then told Chacha Jimenez, yo, that gang, we gotta get this political. He makes Chacha turn a gang into the Young Lords Party, which it eventually would have 14 chapters. The same attack against the Black Panther Party for self-defense was the same COINTELPRO tactics against the Young Lords Party. And when J. Edgar Hoover says that Fred Hampton, they want to stop the rise of a Black Messiah, the second movement deemed a threat is the Puerto Rican independence movement. So they start going after independistas on the island, and then they start going after Young Lords. You have another revolutionary group, the FALN, out of your hometown, Chicago, who took it a lot further than other organizations did. But by the mid-80s, they were all arrested. The Puerto Rican FALN group of 11 people were the only people ever charged with seditious conspiracy in the history of the criminal courts. And then the last thing on this history is that in the early 50s, when Johnson & Johnson started testing for birth control methods, they they put IUDs in 1/3 of the women in Puerto Rico, mostly what we call the jíbaro, the one that works in the fields, and the African. They sterilized 1/3 of our population. It was so common, this program they were running was so pervasive that women of that generation just call it la operación. Like when my grandmother told me, she's like, I didn't get it because I was working, and my grandmother was just had a little bit more resources and understanding to be like, I'm not letting white men come and tell me like what should be in my body. And the same doctor would eventually go to Lincoln Hospital in the Bronx and sterilize 12,000 African-American women and other Latina women.
Even those of us who've heard it before, it's always like a reminder of like, oh, this is so much worse than I realized, you know, just when you connect it that way. So I always appreciate your ability to connect all that.
It's a reinforcement that also Puerto Rico is a colony. Like territory is a euphemism. It's a way for the U.S. to look a little less terrible. But what is the territory except a colony? Puerto Rico's taxed without representation. The economy's altered without representation. And the consequences of debt are like austerity measures on Puerto Rican people. I just thought maybe if you could, like, some of the things that have happened, especially of late, that kind of reinforce Puerto Rico is still a colony.
And with that colonial colonization comes the people who control the wealth, right? And high venture capitalists have been controlling the wealth, and it's never, quote, trickled down to people in Puerto Rico. If Puerto Rico was ever a state, again, never gonna happen. We would be 51st in every indicator of like health, monetary, education, and all of that, right? The average Puerto Rican family before Hurricane Maria made $31,000 a year. we can look at the whole lens of it, of just like, you know, when you're a colony, you don't control your money, and then people are corrupt. And that's why so many politicians in Puerto Rico have been caught. Like yearly, there's like massive indictments against politicians all over the island. But the 2008 recession really dealt a blow to Puerto Rico, because just as our folks were buying houses, and then those balloon payments that happened in Puerto Rico. So then more, if any wealth, any family accumulated wealth at that point, that was gone. And then Hurricane Maria. And the big thing with Hurricane Maria that we're facing is one, people legitimately cannot find the deeds to their homes. But if you come from the Caribbean, that's not how like families hand down stuff. Like basically, there was a letter where my abuela died. She like wrote all her grandchildren, and she was like, Rosie gets the house, you guys get my clothes, my jewelry. But I got my abuela's house, but we haven't been able to find the deed. But we have my uncle living there, maintaining, taking it, taxes, the few taxes that he has to pay. But post Hurricane Maria, that's how people are losing their homes. And also that Hurricane Maria forced an exodus of Puerto Rico to now Orlando and other parts of Florida. There are no jobs in Puerto Rico except tourism. So COVID hit hard. All of that is tied. And when PROMESA was the bill that was supposed to deal with the debt. Well, it's what you said, Hari, austerity, right? So PROMESA assigned a board of financial officers who live in the United States and meet once a month on Wall Street to decide what is going to get paid and what is not. Same that they've done to Detroit and other cities of majority people of color, financial takeover. And that's where we're at. So PROMESA allowed that to happen. And Lin-Manuel Miranda, his father, Nidia Velasquez, Congresswoman, and Congressman Jose Serrano all supported it. And that was after 2 years of meetings with Boricuas who were like, please do not support this. Do not give this to Obama. They supported it. Obama signed it. I have a big problem right now with AOC, Congresswoman AOC, Congresswoman Nidia Velasquez. All they're talking about in their bill is to have the conversation. It's like reparations. Mm-hmm. Why do we have to have conversations? What's the policy? And their only thing they should be saying is, Puerto Rico has a right to self-determination. It must be taken up by the United Nations. All debt cancel and begin a reparations process to the people on the island of Puerto Rico because of everything the system has extracted. And we got to do it quick, because now these white boys like Brock and the Bitcoin bros,
Brock Pierce,
are actually in Puerto Rico trying to create what they call protopias. So they're going into parts that still have not recovered, don't have too much leadership, and getting some rich white land developers to help them bid to buy parcels of land so they can create protopias that work on Bitcoin currency.
Mm. And gentrification, if white gentrification is like a continuation of colonialism, which it clearly appears to be, Can you talk a little bit about Act 60 and how Act 60 allows for stuff like this to happen a lot more easily than it could have?
What Act 60 basically does is, first, Puerto Ricans don't pay federal tax. That doesn't mean they don't pay state and local taxes, right? Second, if you live in Puerto Rico 151 days as someone who lives in the United States and you spend that much time, which is really just getting a P.O. box and saying you live there, you pay no taxes in the United States.
Oh, there it is. there's the loophole.
And then there's tax assessments that are being made at homes, right? And the banks are like, it's worth nothing. There are people coming there with cash where people have been for 3 years struggling. What is a family who has nothing left? They don't have the school. What are people going to do? Somebody offers you $50,000 and it's like, listen, there's mad jobs in Orlando and Miami. Mm. You see the very young people or very old. The 20 to 40 age, I know it's two decades, but they're the ones that are fleeing, as well as doctors. And that's why so many doctors are ending up in Orlando, right? Because they needed to hire doctors, or usually Puerto Ricans would have migrated to New York or Chicago, but those are too gentrified. And at least being in Orlando, you're still 1 hour away from home, basically. Unless something dramatically changes in the next year or two around canceling the debt and giving a way for Puerto Ricans to repatriate back. I have a lot of friends who've done that. I want to do that in the next 10 years. You know, that's what me and my family are making plans to be like, okay, we're going to go back. But that requires us, again, as Puerto Ricans here, being on the forefront of the fight. Yes, we're in the diaspora and we have mad more privileges, but we can build something better. And honestly, the last time I was there, this was in 2019, those protests, I haven't felt like that, I would say, since the Amadou Diallo protests or when we were protesting for the U.S. Navy to leave Vieques. The amount of LGBTQ, Afro-identified Black Boricuas, I was crying all the time because I have never seen that. But also the elders, maybe some of the Puerto Ricans that believe in statehood, maybe the real fancy ones, maybe the Catholic ones that think LGBTQ people are living in sin. In some crazy way, all of these people were together for one cause, remove the governor. And that happened. So we have to now be on that, like, if we don't do something right now, there will be a Puerto Rico without Puerto Ricans.
It feels like it's like the risk of the Hawaiianization of Puerto Rico.
Never. We can't.
Yeah.
We cannot let that happen. And I believe in my heart that we won't. And I believe part of it is we've gotten all our political prisoners, except one is out. They're all in Puerto Rico. Oscar Lopez Rivera, 45 years in prison. The first time I seen him was Hurricane Maria. And then when I went back for the protest, he was right there with Bad Bunny and Residente. I was like, and that's exactly where he should be leading. They said 1.5 million people. We only have 2.3 left on the island.
Wow. What I meant by the Hawaiianization was the fact that, like, you know, you have island nation, colonized, turned into a state. White people own so much of the land. And even though white people are called Haoles and made fun of, there's a lot of power amongst that white minority. So this is...
And a lot of rich white folks and rich folks in general, not just white folks.
Right,
of course. Sort of see it as, like, this place where you can sort of create your own... your own paradise and buy up big swaths of land and build giant houses and not really interact with
the culture. And that's what they're doing. That's happening every day, all day on the island. Hurricane Maria was a turning point. Before Hurricane Maria, my family was very purposeful. I was always every summer in Puerto Rico. So I have connections to my family there. A lot of folks don't. My uncle used to be like, I would be like, why aren't we independent? And he said, oh, no, everybody's an independista at night in the club with the lights out. Like, and part of that, because that generation witnessed the assassinations. It wasn't just the leaders I brought up. There were many assassinations of many leaders, all coming through COINTELPRO and something called La Carpetas, which it joined the FBI with the CIA, with the local police in Puerto Rico to target and assassinate radical, mostly young people in Puerto Rico. When I was reporting there with the crew I took down, more older people that usually would tend to say, let's just keep it status quo. And part of it is because most Boricuas do get their food. They're dependent on food stamps. Mm. They're dependent on EBT. And also, if they get a good job, they're really dependent on their pension. I was talking to so many elders, and they're like, yeah, this is it. It's time to be independent. And what I thought was, like, a lot of people in Puerto Rico have been scared or are scared because they none of us know what a free Puerto Rico could look like and what that's going to require at so many levels. But after Trump threw paper towels, everybody the next day was like, fuck it, we'll do it for self. Because that's exactly what happened. The United States government abandoned Puerto Rico and the people helped and have created a new Puerto Rico, the farming, younger people going, why am I paying $9 for a mango when we grow them?
Rosa, you said a lot of things about what's happening with Puerto Rico that's made my blood boil. But I will tell you the thing that upset me the most is $9 for a mango. Are you fucking kidding me? As a South Asian, are you fucking kidding with $9 for a mango? How dare they?
Bro, $8 for half a gallon of milk? Because the Jones Act is why we have no economy. What the Jones Act essentially does is we can import, but we can't export as Puerto Rico. And then other nations, in any time of crisis, and this happened exactly during Hurricane Maria, nations were sending help. Cuba was sending doctors, Venezuela was sending oil, China was sending food. And we were not allowed to accept them because of the Jones Act. So it's up to the United States government during a natural disaster, a federal disaster. They decide what help is going to get in. So all of this kind of stuff could break a nation. It just made us stronger.
Is there the things we can do, those of us who want to support this fight?
Yeah, I would say first and foremost, everybody should read a book called War Against All Puerto Ricans by Nelson Dennis. Everything that I talked about, he writes about within the context of that we have to see Puerto Rico as being under consistent military occupation. Naomi Klein, right after Maria went, she did about 67-page article called The Battle for Paradise. And she's the one that was the first one to document Brock Pierce and his plans on Pretopia. And lastly, in Puerto Rico, my mentor, Dr. Maita Moreno Vega, she went to retire and she started an organization at 77. She's going to be mad I said her name, but that's how she is. It's called Afro Corridor. And what she's been doing the last year is bringing young, obviously Afro-Black Puerto Ricans to the roots of the bomba, the plena, the food, but the politics. Those are some good resources to start with.
Rosa, thank you so much for being on. For your record third appearance on Politically Reactive, we needed this conversation. We're so glad we had this conversation with you. Thanks for being on.
Thank you all for coming back. Congratulations on the new one in your life.
Thank
you. Now you're about to have some teenagers. Holler at your girl.
Rosa Clemente is an organizer, political commentator, and scholar of Afro-Latinx identity.
Keep up with her journalism and advocacy work and book her to come to your organization or university at rosaclemente.net. rosaclemente.net. And if you want some inside scoop on the making of Judas and the Black Messiah, where she was an associate producer, stick around after the credits. It's good.
Coming up, we get educated on asexuality. After the election in November, we talked to the very funny and talented Sarah Cooper about what she'd learned from spending hundreds of hours lip-syncing Donald Trump.
Do you think you know anything about Trump that other people don't know because you've studied him so much? Is there anything that you've observed? It could be good, bad, or indifferent. Just something that you like feel like.
I have a sneaking suspicion that he's kind of an asexual guy. Huh. And like even in that clip, the Access Hollywood, like he was being egged on a lot by Billy Bush. You know, like he was like, "Look, your girl's hot as shit. Look at the legs," like all that stuff. And Trump was kind of like, "Yeah, looks good," but he was. He seems to be so obsessed with himself that I don't think he's this, like, I think he's into sex and stuff like that just because he thinks he's supposed to, or maybe it makes him feel macho, but I don't think he actually is, you know what I mean? He's a germaphobe. Like, I actually think that he really is asexual.
As you can hear, we didn't question Sarah's way of talking about Trump as asexual. I mean, I certainly felt weird about it, but not enough to follow up with our producer and editor to do something about it.
And yes, some of you called us out about it. Thank you for doing so in a way that called us in.
Hey, Kamau and Hari. I'm a queer woman living in Chicago, and I've actually seen you both perform stand-up live on more than one occasion. I have a lot of respect for the two of you, and me and my closest friends absolutely love your work. That said, me and my partner, who, full disclosure, is gender, non-binary, and ace, were listening to the latest episode featuring Sarah Cooper the other day, and they were pretty offended by her comment about Donald Trump being asexual. And I really want you both to understand how these comments can actually be harmful to asexuals. There are a group of queer people who are, even by LGBTQIA standards, considered fringe. It's a nuanced subject, and I hope that as two conscious straight males, you hear this criticism and you take it to heart, and maybe even consider inviting someone who happens to be asexual to speak from personal experience.
You're absolutely right, and we have. Yasmin Benoit is a model and asexuality activist, one of the founders of International Asexuality Day, which was celebrated for the first time this week. Yasmin, thank you so much for being on our podcast today. So before you respond to the clip, I just want to say, you know, we're not blaming Sarah Cooper. This is not like something we're doing, like throwing her under the bus. You know, because I think there's a lot of people that don't understand what asexuality is, or if they kind of know what it is, they can't, like us, I think we couldn't go deep on it. So we really want to know what went wrong there and kind of what we should know about asexuality.
Well, I mean, quite a few things went wrong there, but I sense that you didn't actually anticipate that that was where the conversation was going before it went there.
Yes.
Yeah, they teach you don't ask a question you don't know the answer to, and I didn't know the answer, so that was...
I don't like to speculate on the sexualities of people in general, but based on my observations of Donald Trump, I don't think there's a huge amount of actual evidence that would suggest whether or not he is asexual. People assume that Donald Trump is a bit of a narcissist, an egotist, probably lacking in some of the classically psychopathic traits in the literal sense of being very charismatic and very assertive and kind of good with people, but then also lacking in empathy and kind of having a kind of reckless fearlessness, and that also coming across in a way that is quite mean. I think a lot of those traits are some that people attribute to Donald Trump. And unfortunately, those are also stereotypes that are commonly attributed to asexual people. They often think that if you're asexual and you don't experience sexual attraction to people, or you experience very low levels of sexual attraction to people, then it's because you are probably a bit of a psychopath, and you're probably a narcissist, and you're probably obsessed with yourself, or you probably have some kind of fear, or you think you're too good for anybody. And if you were to actually have sex in any capacity, you probably don't have like a normal understanding of it. Because a lot of people do interpret any kind of asexual characteristic as being a manifestation of some kind of personality issue. And I think that the stereotypes were coming into play because those are also things that people say to me. I think it also just comes down to a lot of people don't know what asexuality is, but they still subconsciously have an opinion about it. And they'll consequently still have those misconceptions and spread them without even necessarily thinking that they're doing that.
Well, can you define it for us? I think, you know, because we know what it's not. Yeah, which is great.
I mean, it's just experiencing little to low levels of sexual attraction. That's literally all it is. It's the sexual orientation that isn't oriented anywhere, but is on a spectrum to an extent. I mean, some people might experience it a little bit. Some people might never experience it. Similarly, there are nuances to it. You might be asexual, but still be able to enjoy sex. Some people don't need to be sexually attracted to someone to still have sex with them or still enjoy sex. And for some people, that's a no-go. Some asexual people still have quite a high libido. Some don't. Some experience romantic attraction. Some don't. So there are nuances to it. But the gist of it is experiencing little to no sexual attraction.
So I think that's interesting because right now, even in what you just said, I'm like, I didn't know the idea that you would have... The idea that you would... See, I'm trying not to screw up as I talk about how we screwed up. The idea that you would be asexual and still have a high libido, my brain just went, like, that's, I mean, you know, that's not something I ever understood before.
I guess some people have different definitions of libido. Libido does not necessarily meaning I need to have sex with a high amount of people. It might just mean I'm horny often and I like to masturbate on the regular. So that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with who you're sexually attracted to. So it just kind of depends on your definition of libido or sex drive. Some asexual people have had sex. Some asexual people have never had sex. Some asexual people are in relationships with people that aren't asexual. Some, like me, I don't do romantic relationships. So, yeah, there's a lot of different asexual experiences, but the one thing it has in common is experiencing little to low levels of sexual attraction, which isn't a side effect of something. It's just another sexual orientation, really.
Last week we had Lala Holston Zanella on talking about sex work, and sort of the takeaway from that is that we just don't talk about sex enough in this society, so that we don't have room for all the nuance.
Yeah, it's true. And we're not too good at having, I feel like we're not too good at having new conversations. I feel like we just kind of rehash the same conversations. Whenever you kind of go, oh, who's a new perspective? They're like, I don't feel like anyone's talking about that yet, so we don't need to go there. Like, well, we could start the conversation. But yeah, I feel like that's kind of something that, I don't know, I tend to see a lot as well. And I think that's why asexuality doesn't get included in the conversation that much. People are kind of scared to go there because they haven't seen that many other people go there yet. So thank you for going there.
even in the way we did.
It's a starting point.
I think terms are super important, just, you know, partly for people to even get a grasp on something. So can you, because you mentioned this a little bit, but can you talk about what it means to be romantic or aromantic, and also what the term ace means?
Yeah, so ace is, well, for one, it's just kind of like a shorter way of saying asexual. But some people also, if they don't feel like they're 100% asexual, and there isn't really an idea of being 100% asexual, but if you kind of feel like there is, and maybe you don't want to like put the full label on you, kind of like when people might not want to say, oh, I'm gay, I'm bi, but they'll say queer. It's like you don't want to say asexual and you might say ace. So there's kind of two kind of ways to use the term. Romantic attraction and romantic orientations is something that is a kind of a distinction that the asexual community makes a lot, but I also heard the bisexual community and the pansexual community make that distinction too, because sometimes who you're sexually attracted to, or like the gender you're most sexually attracted to, might not also be the one that you're most romantically attracted to. Like you might, I don't know, for example, as a girl, maybe I would like to, I prefer having sex with women, but then you might have more romantic attraction to men. It's kind of like that kind of thing. You could also have no romantic attraction anywhere at all, in the same way as asexuality. So that's where the term aromantic comes into it, because there are lots of asexual people who do still experience romantic attraction, and they are still in romantic relationships, and they might be, as you, instead of saying homosexual because they're not sexually attracted, you would say like homo romantic or bi romantic or hetero romantic or aromantic. So it's not a distinctly asexual thing, but the asexual community does tend to apply that kind of split attraction model.
Is there objectification as an asexual person? Like if somebody finds out that you're asexual, that I would imagine that there'd be some sort of like, oh, I wish I was, because I'm so sexual. Does that happen?
Yeah, I mean, you name it, I've heard it. Out of all the things I've heard, I'm not entirely against that one. If anyone associates asexuality as being some kind of benefit, I'm like, well, that's better than seeing it as a negative, so I'm not going to be mad at that. But yeah, I definitely had the, oh my God, like my life would be so much easier, or I'd be able to focus on different things more. I'd be more productive with my time. I've definitely heard that. And I'm like, well, I can't, that then puts the idea that I'm incredibly productive of my time. I play a lot of Sims 4. That's not entirely the case, but I don't have to think about certain things as much as some other people might do.
I think people don't even see asexuality as a possibility. A lot of people don't even have that in their, you know, list of possible orientations. So what is it like, and I know this varies from person to person, what is it like to come out as asexual to friends and family?
Long-winded and awkward, usually. it's not really the same as if I was to say, oh, I'm gay, and then people know what you're talking about. You get the combination of people don't know what you're talking about, but they still feel like they know more about it than you do. So I would say I'm asexual, and then it would be like, oh no, you're just well-behaved. You're too young to understand. You haven't met the right person yet. Might want to get that checked out. You're probably gay and you haven't worked it out. Probably just, people just assume it's something to do with your personality. It's something to do with your experiences. It's some kind of insecurity. Like, people come up with every explanation aside from maybe you're just asexual. So it took me, like, from the time I've always known I was asexual, I've been trying to explain it to people for a long time. I used the term asexual initially when I was 15. People didn't buy it until I was like 21, 22. And that was only because it was in the UK press and people believe what they read in the newspaper more than what you tell them in person. Yeah, it was a long process before people actually took me seriously.
That's so frustrating. To me, it almost feels like you're saying, I'm a unicorn. No, you couldn't be a unicorn. That horn will fall off. You can't be a unicorn. Like, you know, yeah, you have four legs and you're not. It's like... I'm pretty sure at this point I know what I am.
Yeah, it's like you're not a unicorn. You're just a fancy horse. It's pretty much like that.
I would imagine all the pressure can come from family too, in the same way about like, you know, sort of like, but where are my grandkids going to, you know, sort of the, okay, I realize as I'm asking this, it's sort of dawning me. Of course you could be asexual and also want kids. Thank you. I'm leaving now. I'm done. All right. I'm going to go read some more books instead of asking dumb questions.
You know, you say that, but like that is a weirdly common assumption that I get all the time. It's like, oh, well, so no grandchildren. Oh, so that's the end of your... It's like, where are they going to come from? I'm like, I know my vagina. It's like, well, how would you have children? It's like, I don't know, the way everyone else does it. I don't know. It's like, it's interesting that people put the two things together quite instinctively. I'm not entirely sure where it comes from. But I know asexual people that have kids, so it's very much possible, and it's something that is at present on my to-do list. I might just get a pug and be like, screw that idea, but at the moment, I'm considering it at some point in the future. But that is a very common thing that people think and equate, so don't feel too bad about it, because that is a very common thing that people think.
Oh, no, I'm going to feel bad about it. I'm going to hold this shame for a couple weeks, but that's my operating principle. The major thing that I mean, so much I'm taking with this from this conversation, but the really a major thing is that libido, sexual attraction, and romantic attraction can exist in three separate places.
Yes, like, I think that's true.
I think that's why it's hard to think. That's why I think, like I just did, assume, oh, you're asexual, you won't have kids, because I can't get those into three separate places. I can't get that's four separate places. Wanting to be a parent, having romantic attraction, having a high libido, and having sexual attraction. Society's done a good job of putting those in one bucket, as we say sometimes on the show. And actually, there are four different buckets. We just like to put them all together.
It's true. And another thing that people tend to group into it is actually sexual attitudes, and attitudes towards sex is another one that people put in there. They assume that if you're asexual and you don't feel sexual attraction, then you must be anti-sex. And that is something that leads to asexuality getting cut out of a lot of conversations. People think that you're like a danger to conversations, that you're kind of like advocating for people to not have sex, or you're trying to stifle like sexual liberation. Like that is another thing people group into it.
Do people also assume that you must be afraid of sex?
Yes, that is one of the things where people be like, oh, but you don't seem asexual because I've mentioned sex in front of you and you didn't like, I don't know, combust or something. And it's like, yeah, I know, I'm an adult. I don't know. It's like, yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm sure there are asexual people that like aren't like, they don't like to really talk about sex, or they get uncomfortable if they see sex, or that's kind of around them, but that's not like a given. There are people that aren't asexual that don't really like seeing like particularly sexual stuff going on or talking about those things. So they don't necessarily go hand in hand, but it is also an assumption that you have to be kind of like scared of sex to some degree if you're asexual.
Any Meghan Markle hot takes that you should know about? You're a black woman in the UK. I feel like we can't leave without talking Meghan Markle.
Well, Piers Morgan is obsessed. That is one thing that if I was his wife, I'd be so embarrassed that my husband has been obsessed with a woman who didn't text him back for like 5 years or something. Can you imagine?
Thank you for coming to the podcast. We really appreciate it. Thank you for your time and patience with us.
Thank you for having me. This is my first American political kind of podcast ever.
So all right.
Thank you. I just get the sex podcasts usually. So thank you for letting me join.
Yasmin Benoit is a model and asexuality activist.
You can learn more and find resources about asexuality education and visibility at asexuality.org.
Next up, a case of child slavery and corporate immunity.
Yeah, we really fucked up. Last month, we had former acting Solicitor General Neil Katyal on the show. We talked about a lot of things: affirmative action, what it's like to argue before the Supreme Court, Merrick Garland, and the prosecution of the insurrectionists at the Capitol.
But when the episode came out, we immediately heard on Twitter about something we didn't talk about: two Supreme Court cases, Nestle v. Doe and Cargill v. Doe. Neil advocated on behalf of Nestle and Cargill. We should have known about these cases. We should have done our research. We should have asked Neil about them. Totally our bad.
We did invite Neil to come back and talk about them, but he said he's too swamped leading the prosecution of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd, which makes complete sense, and we certainly support him focusing on that prosecution. Our invitation to come talk remains open.
But given what these cases are about, huge issues that involve corporate responsibility and exploitation of not only workers, but trafficked child workers on cocoa plantations in West Africa, we knew we had to address this.
So we invited Oren Nimni, litigation director at Rights Behind Bars and legal editor at Current Affairs Magazine, to fill us in on the arguments and what's at stake. Oren, thank you so much for joining us on Politically Reactive. I've always been curious about Nestle. Obviously, I've read some things that they've done that aren't too great, have a mixed relationship. Childhood, of course, who doesn't like Quick Milk? I was a strawberry man.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I was a strawberry man.
I think I actually should
thank
leave.
You for coming on today. Thank you, Oren. You clearly can't stay on the podcast with a strawberry man. So I
was a strawberry man. And so obviously, you know, they got me hooked early, right? And then obviously, you know, I went to college. Obviously, I've seen enough protests. Okay, Nestle bad. Got it. then I found out that my favorite coffee shop, Blue Bottle, San Francisco-based, got bought by Nestle, which, again, heartbreaking. So, again, that's not a lot of knowledge regarding Nestle. So that being said, can you lay out these cases, Nestle versus Doe and Cargill versus Doe? I think most people may have heard about Nestle and Cargill, huge multinationals in food and agriculture. But who are the plaintiffs and what are they suing the companies over?
The plaintiffs are six children who were trafficked from Mali to the Ivory Coast and then put into slave camps on cocoa bean plantations, where they were subjected to brutal torture, to, you know, working 12 to 14 hour days, obviously unpaid, being whipped. You know, one of the plaintiffs put forth that they had seen, you know, one kid getting their feet cut as a punishment. And so just like really, really like fucking sick stuff. And so they end up suing the Nestle Corporation in Cargill, basically saying, look, you guys are huge players in the cocoa market. Whatever you do controls what goes on here. And you know that these cocoa plantations in the Ivory Coast are using child slavery. In fact, you send them agricultural supplies, you pay them, you send them training materials and send trainers over there on how to do their agricultural practices better. You know all this is going on, and nonetheless, you are creating a supply chain that uses these plantations that use child slavery, and you're doing it so that you can undercut the competition.
So they know very well that this is happening. Like, they know. Not like they're looking the other way.
They very clearly know. They both know specifically about these plantations, and they kind of know just generally. Like, one, you don't get into the cocoa bean trade not without knowing a little bit about child slavery. But two, they actually have for years lobbied against laws that would have shed light and transparency on how child slavery is used in particular agricultural products. So they have both known and really opposed anyone looking at it. They don't want anyone else to know. Particularly over the past 10 years, they've put a bunch of money into lobbying against legislation that would basically lead to transparency about supply chains, and particularly about the use of unethical labor practices sort of on the mild end, and child slavery on the sort of devastating end. So it's mostly been around that. I mean, I will say that Nestle was very, very adamant in its briefs that it does not support child slavery as a concept. But it was also one of those things where if you have to say, I don't support child slavery a bunch of times, I mean, maybe you should think about what you're doing.
That's one of the saddest things I've ever heard, by the way. You don't get into the cocoa bean industry without knowing about child labor.
No, no, no. He said child slavery.
That's even worse.
No, no. He said you don't get into the cocoa bean trade without knowing a little bit about child slavery. I remembered that's it. Even I will never. It will always be imprinted on my brain, that sentence, because it sounds like the beginning of like a Coen Brothers film or something.
After this, we can go make it.
Nesli and Cargill, they were both sued under the Alien Tort Statute. How does that work, and how has its use been narrowed over time?
Yeah, so the Alien Tort Statute is a little bit of a weird thing. It's a super, super old law that first came into use in the United States, basically when a French guy got into a fight with another guy in a French embassy, and everyone was basically like, well, a bunch of French people are fighting. Can they sue each other in United States court? And the answer was yes, because the United States didn't want to be a place where lawless shit could happen and no one would send their people to the United States for fear that they would get punched and or verbally assaulted and escape liability. So it wasn't really used that much for a good long time of in the United States until the 70s or so, when the Center for Constitutional Rights and other human rights advocates decided to use the Alien Tort Statute to advocate for human rights and international human rights. And so there was a series of cases in the 70s and 80s suing bad actors in regimes that had tortured people and committed genocide. So there was a famous case called Flartiga, which is about this person that was tortured, and their torturer ended up coming to the United States. And when the person was in the United States, the person that was tortured, Flartiga, sued her torturer. And the question was like, well, can you sue someone who is not a U.S. national about stuff that happened outside of the U.S.? The answer was actually yes. And so once that was decided, that even that stuff didn't need to happen in the US, that just there needed to be some kind of US connection, you could get money from people. People started using this in a bunch of different ways. Over time, though, and as human rights abuses kind of changed, the courts decided to narrow this law because it was being used pretty widely, and then people started suing companies. And so there was a narrowing of this. For example, there was a famous case called Kiobel against Dutch Petroleum, which is the holding company that owns Shell. That didn't work out. And so basically, this has been narrowed over time. And the most recent case before Nestle was a case called Jesner versus Arab Bank, where the question really about corporations was put front and center. Can you hold corporations liable for crimes they commit outside of the United States? And the court kind of dodged that question. They were like, well, you definitely can't hold foreign corporations liable, but they left it open if you could hold American corporations liable for things that they might have done elsewhere. And so that's what this case presents, because Nestle was based in California, now is based in Virginia. But one of the main questions of the case is, if a corporation does something terrible, but they do it outside of the United States to people, and the stuff happens outside of the United States, can people sue in the United States to get money from them?
So we had Neil Katyal on, and of course, his connection to this case, it did not. I believe you've listened to the show, so you can imagine our fans had some questions about our decision to have Mr. imagine. Katyal on.
We didn't go to page 3 of Google. That was our big mistake. You looked at the...
So Neil was arguing on behalf of the companies Cargill and Nestle in front of the Supreme Court. What was his argument?
His argument is much broader than what happened to the children in this case, which is, I mean, the devastating thing, right, is what happened to the kids. The broader thing, though, is what Neil Katyal was arguing, and it's something that could be devastating for basically everyone, at least as far as the Alien Tort Statute is concerned. So his argument was basically, look, you can't hold any corporation liable under the Alien Tort Statute. You know, corporations weren't held liable back in the 1780s. And as a result, there's just like no reason that you should hold corporations liable. And even if you do hold corporations liable, you can't hold them liable for aiding and abetting terrible things. You can only hold them liable if they actually do the bad thing. So if Nestle went over and like bought and held people in slavery, maybe you could hold them liable. He still says no, because they're a corporation. But even if you could hold a corporation liable, they would have to do something like that rather than just like funding, training, and providing equipment. And so those arguments are super broad. And he had a couple of other like policy arguments in the briefs that will also make you be like, what the fuck? So one of the other policy arguments was one of the reasons to hold this corporate rule that no corporations can be held liable is because if you didn't do that, it might put U.S. corporations at a competitive disadvantage to other corporations if they're not allowed to use child slavery, but other corporations
oh,
are.
Oh, no.
The second one, which got people mad, rightfully so, was in the briefs they said, also, just as an aside, you know, in the Nuremberg trials, didn't hold the corporation who made Zyklon B accountable. So why should you hold Nestle accountable? And maybe that's just a thing you don't want to write down.
Yeah. Maybe we start referencing the Nazis in a way that, like, here's what they got away with. Why should we? Yikes!
Maybe have your editor just cross that out and be like, fair point on the law, but maybe it's gonna make you look like a monster. By not holding these corporations liable, what you get into is actually there's no one to hold liable. And Kochel right. and Nestle had a bunch of arguments. They're like, oh, don't worry. There's a bunch. So they brought up this. They're like, you could hold individuals liable, or like you could sue the company not under the ATS. You could sue them under like Ivory Coast law. And like none of those are actually things, because like the individuals usually are shielded from liability. And also it's the company that really has the money and is really constructing these supply chains. And historically, Ivory Coast law, not really so great at holding corporations accountable just generally, but also like at being accessible to former child slaves. There's not like a court that's like former child slaves can run in and be like, yeah, I now have a lawyer and I'm going to sue this CEO of Nestle for that flight that he took over here. But that's sort of why people are trying to sue these corporations, is because they are responsible in a macro sense, but also because they're the ones that kind of have their hands in all of these things and have the pockets that could pay out for like this kind of harm if there's any way to compensate for it.
This is the reason why, even though there are companies that existed during American enslavement, Black descendants of slaves cannot hold those companies accountable. And reparations is, you can't get reparations through the court system. You have to do it through shame and hashtags. Is that what I'm understanding?
Like, I don't want to knock anyone. If someone wanted to try that suit, I would be right on board. And I think maybe you could, not under the Alien Tort Statute. There's no concept of holding a corporation liable under the laws of nations sort of in the 1700s. And similarly, they say there's no concept of like aiding and abetting. There's only like direct actions done by specific people. So like the torturer held liable, or like the slaver held liable, and even like 10 slavers held liable. But if those 10 slavers decided to form a corporation, then you could not hold them liable.
If they decided to turn it into the slavery corporation, suddenly they all get away with it.
I mean, this question was asked by a conservative justice, by Justice Barrett, during the argument. She was like, okay, just to be clear, if people are tortured, you could hold them liable for that. And Neil Kochel was like, yeah, of course you could hold them liable for torture. And she was like, but if it was a corporation that did the torture, you couldn't. And he's like, yeah, well, no, of course you couldn't hold them liable for that, because it's a corporation.
How did the other justices react?
Most of them were, even the conservative ones, were like a little bit horrified by the possible results that this would lead to. Justice Kagan sort of asked the best questions, and she kind of went down this line of like, so if it was like one person, yes, two people, yes, 10 people, yes, 100 people, yes, corporation, no. And so like a lot of them were asking that those kinds of questions and trying to probe at that. And there were some weird questions about like pirates and whether pirates could be held liable, and because the law is dumb and this is the way that it works. I mean, the real thing is like all of them seemed very disturbed by this. And they also, not that many years ago, said that foreign corporations couldn't be held liable. So I think that it's possible that even though they like were saying, oh, this is very disturbing, there's a lot of child slavery, that child slavery might win.
So what are the long-term implications of this? Like, you were talking about how bad this could be, but what would be the implications of this particular argument was to work?
If Nestle wins on all of its arguments, more or less the Alien Tort Statute is no longer usable. I mean, you could use it for really, really narrow things, like an individual person did a specific thing and they had like, you know, a connection to the US, but it would be a very, very narrow window of facts. And so this kind of tool that people have been using for human rights to get people some kind of compensation would be much, much less usable. I mean, there are ways for the court to agree with some of their arguments and not go that far. And there's also ways that Congress could pass, as they have since this case even was filed, you know, things around statutes around like compensation for torture or compensation for trafficking, although many of those statutes also exclude corporations.
Oh, no.
I mean, there is a thing. There's just such a thing. I mean, I feel like I hear this from lawyers sometimes, like you have to uphold the law whether you agree with the law or not. And I'm always like, why do you got to do that?
This case was interesting because it's sort of this conversation pops up from time to time, like amongst lawyers or I guess now because it's the internet, like on law Twitter, which is not a place that anyone should go to. And basically, like the debate is that repeats itself is, should lawyers be amoral technicians just working for their clients, or are they responsible for the justice of their causes? And, you know, I think there's good reasons that lawyers should be responsible for the justice of the causes that they choose to work in. But, you know, there is that argument that you were saying, which is just like, you know, law's the law. You get the client, you do the thing. But you kind of choose the client most of the time.
Yeah.
Especially if you're representing corporations. If a biologist was like, oh, well, I could be curing cancer, but instead I'm developing bioweapons. But like, you know what? Like, potato, potato, those things are the same. People would be like, no, those things obviously aren't the same. But lawyers say that and they're like, oh, those things sound the same. Just doing law.
Thank you, Aaron, for being here. We had a lot of questions, so we appreciate your time answering them.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. It was good to talk about it. And I now actually do have a craving for strawberry milk, so I'm going to go back and
yes.
just give it a quick try. I mean, or you can just use that as a plug so we don't get sued by Nestle. It's an advertisement for strawberry milk.
Get a generic brand if you can. You're a generic brand.
Yeah, I'm sure the generic brands are real above board. I'm sure that. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Aura Nimni is litigation director at Rights Behind Bars and legal editor at Current Affairs Magazine.
And we also can't have this episode in without talking about a segment we're calling Matt's Bad. These are things that Matt Martin, our producer, editor, our North Star, cut out of episodes that made Hari upset.
He didn't make you upset. This is some funny shit we cut out. This stuff's good, though. This stuff's real good, especially the Trump-Penn stuff they're about to hear. Holy shit.
One of the funny things I heard about the Trump-Pence thing is apparently they had a meeting finally where they talked, and by the end, Pence apologized to Trump.
Oh, my God, man. What does he have on you?
I'm sorry,
that's the only thing. Does he have something on you that you don't want people to know? Does it involve Jeffrey Epstein? Like, what is it exactly? He tried to kill you. My God, literally people were yelling Hank Pence, they would have murdered you.
Yep, I'm sorry, Daddy. Papa, I'm so sorry, Papa. Hand me your belt, Papa Mike.
Oh no, not the belt, Papa.
I'm gonna just leave that there and let everybody create the scenario in their head after that. That's as far as I'm going with it. If I was on stage doing stand-up comedy, I would take it to its illogical conclusion, but on a podcast, I'm gonna just let it sit right there.
I'm still laughing about that shit. It's hilarious. But if that didn't get you, how about this one? Happy to know the show is still going, Kamau.
It's still going. Yeah, still going.
What network is it on?
CNN.
Ah, yes, the news network. Very good.
Yeah, the Central News Network. Is that what this is that what it stands for?
I actually don't know what it's.
Continental News Network? The country's news network?
I really don't know what the C is. Wow.
Wow.
Capital News Network?
Seems like it's long enough ago that continental would have been a word that Ted Turner used.
Continental News Now. Next time you're on CNN doing a talking head thing, try to throw in Continental News Network and see what happens.
Look, as someone who works for the Continental News Network,
Like, would they even catch you? Would Don Lemon be like, that's not what it should... Like, would they even... We'd like, I don't know. I guess that's what it's for.
Don, you and me both work for the Continental News Network.
Yeah, that shit's hilarious, Matt. The hell's wrong with you? You're doing a great job, by the way. You're doing a really good job. I feel bad even raising my voice in jest. You've done a fantastic job. You fucked up here, but you've done a fantastic job.
We can't just leave well enough alone. That's it for this week. Thanks to Rosa Clemente, Yasmin Benoit, and Oren Nimni.
And thank you to all the listeners who have gotten in touch with us this season and let us know when we've gotten it wrong and when we've gotten it right. We always want to hear what you think about the conversations we're having on Politically Reactive.
Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and keep your comments and questions coming with the hashtag Politically Reactive.
You know, the season's over, but you can still leave us a voicemail at 917-477-6525.
Again, that's 917-477-6525.
And also, wherever you get your podcast, please rate and review the show. It helps people find us, and that allows our ratings to get higher and lets us come back, I don't know, for season 4. I would suggest you start commenting and taking this part of the podcast seriously. If you remember, early in the year, we told you, if you didn't do this shit, we wouldn't come back. Well, we're at that point again. It's a crossroads, everybody. I don't want to hear people saying, hey, when's the show coming back? Why don't you stop asking me and rate us? I don't care if you're using different email accounts to do it. You do what you got to do, baby.
Hari, are you a little sleep deprived from having a kid?
I'm so tired.
All I'm going to promote is Donors Choose, which is the organization I work with. I'm on the board of directors of Donors Choose that helps schools and teachers. It helps teachers raise money for projects. Could be as big as like a new computer or as small as snacks or anything in between or a class trip. Go to donorschoose.org. You can search by your zip code. You can search by your birthday. You can search by, some teacher you had in school, in elementary school, and donate to support projects on Donors Choose. Donorschoose.org.
And again, Kamau and I have Netflix specials, Warn Your Relatives, and Private School Negro. I think you can guess who's is who. You can get my documentary, The Problem with Apu, on HBO Max. And apparently, Kamau still has a show on CNN called United Shades of America, which people have told me is very good.
Yes, it is very good. And actually, it premieres May 2nd, Sunday, May 2nd, at 10 p.m. on CNN. Politically Reactive is a production of Topic Studios and a Warner Media Podcast Network. Executive producers are Maria Zuckerman and Christy Gressman.
And W. Kamau Bell.
And Hari K. Kondabolu.
The show is produced by Matt Martin, Malachi Seeger-Sakir, and Kelly Rafferty. Will Stanton engineers and mixes the show.
And thanks as always to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive. You were one of the producers of Judas and the Black Messiah, bringing that across the finish line, which was as I know, could not have been easy. But you were there on the scene.
Yeah, I was an associate producer. I had met Shaka Khan through this collective that Charles Khan, Ryan Coogler, and Ava DuVernay started, I think, 7 or 8 years ago, called Blackout. And then Pastor McBride was like, no, we need some organizers. It can't just be artists. And they brought in a lot of organizers, and I've stayed the entire time.
Yes.
You know, while it has shifted. But it was also our first big thing we did was the Flint water crisis. And throughout, we would yearly have an MLK event at Riverside Church, obviously not this year. And Shaka was just like, yo, do you know Fred? I was like, talk to him all the time. He's not going to approve this movie. but I'll get you the first meeting. And Obviously he did approve, and it was 3 years of love and struggle and a lot of dudes, man. Even though the person that greenlit it is the sister that's the vice president at Warner Brothers, you know? So that was super exciting. But most of the time I was like, yo, can y'all just answer the question? Can we keep moving, or we're never going to make this movie? But I'm extremely proud of it. I hope people have watched it. And I do know, and Shaka has been very, he's talked about this in so many interviews, that the first version of the movie that he then gave to Black directors, elder Black directors, Hollywood, you know, big ones, were like, yo, you have O'Neill too much in here. You got to put more Fred Hampton. Mm. And but even with that, one of the main contentions with a lot of folks, and you know, a lot of people are still critical of it, some Black Panther elders, some Black Panther cubs, and all of that, was that O'Neal was even in the story. And it's interesting because in talking to Fred throughout these 3 years deeply about this, all Fred ever says is he wasn't the only snitch. He was a snitch, but not the only one. Would I have liked things to be different? Yeah, but Fred was on the set every day. Everything he wanted was accomplished. And the most important thing is we saved the childhood home of Fred Hampton, his father. And they're already making it into like a museum, a community garden, a youth center, and now going to go through the process of trying to register it on the National Park Services. So when people do cross-country trips, my mom took me all over the country. She was amazing. We visited every state before I was like 20. She would just be like, we're driving somewhere. And she would have the list like, oh, here you have to stop because this happened and there's a marker. So all of that happened. And I'm trying to tell folks, like, it's not a documentary. Sorry, that was in my email. It's not a documentary. It's not really a biopic. And that we need like 8 more movies on Fred Hampton, Mark Clark. We need a movie on each Panther, Young Lord, Machateros, like all of them. And hopefully this will be the thing. And I lastly, just on this, I was surprised myself. Last week, Charles Ryan and Shaka were on the front of the Hollywood Reporter. When I'm reading the article, first I emailed them. I'm like, y'all are fine. They're like, that's it, Rose. I'm like, y'all look real good. Yeah, getting ready for the Oscars, right? That this is the first time in Oscar history that an all-Black producing team has been nominated.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Ever. And it is all brothers, right? It's Charles, Shaka, and Ryan are the executive producers.
I don't think people who aren't familiar with Hollywood know how big that is, because like when you're talking about like actors, you know, writers, directors, those are all incredibly important, but there is an aspect of it where it's kind of people like when you're an actor, you're working the land, but you're not actually owning any of the property. The producers actually have the money. The producers are the ones with the power. The producers are the ones with a lot of times with this bigger vision of what this film can do. And oftentimes there's white people all over that.
Yeah.
You know, even good white people, still, there's white people all over that. The idea that it could be an all-Black producing team, that does not happen clearly. Like, it's amazing.
Yeah, that's funny that you say that, because the days I was on the set, I actually was on the set, which I think is the best part of the movie for folks who watched it, is when Chairman Fred goes to a church.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And in it, purposely, you'll see the young lords, the deacons for self-defense, of some of the elders. You'll see a group of brothers with green berets. That was supposed to represent the Black Stone Rangers, and that's problematic because of gang life and culture in Chicago and the closeness that a lot of the elders did have with Fred Hampton. But I was there and Daniel shot that scene 16 times, 12 hours. And when I got there at 8 o'clock in the morning, the only thing I really know about movies is don't get in the way and be quiet. I've never really been on a set like that. And it was so many Black and brown people. And I was like, I said to Charles, I said, where are the white people? He's like, they're in the office making sure we don't go over budget. He's like, we got all the power for that. I was like, okay, I see this. But it's an amazing scene. It made me cry. Every time I watch it, it makes me cry. Like, oh my God.
I mean, keep it funny, man. This one's a funny one. Let's keep it as funny as it possibly can be.
If you make good jokes, I put them in. Yeah. That's one of my policies. No, I like funny.